Democrat publisher of the Western Standard, and you're watching The Pipeline. Today is April 24th, and we've got a great show coming up for you. I'm joined, as always, by Western Standard opinion editor Nigel Hannaford.
Good to be here.
And Western Standard senior Alberta columnist Corey Morgan.
Always thrilled to be here.
You know, we actually screwed up the beginning of the show earlier. We had a great little tete-a-tete going, but when you're just starting over again, you just kind of you lose the flow.
Just can't recreate it.
It would just lack the magic. Okay, well, we've got a great show. We're going to be talking about Trudeau's war on the Constitution. More recently and specifically, his comments that if the provinces don't do what he wants them to do, he's just going to go around them into their areas of jurisdiction. We're going to be talking about those comments specifically, but also putting it in the broader context of his regular attacks on the constitutional order of Canada, constantly hammering into areas of provincial jurisdiction, areas that have gotten him in trouble at the Supreme Court, basic constitutional violations like, I don't know, seizing bank accounts without just cause, things like that. We'll also be talking about his dangerously weak response to something within his jurisdiction, which is condemning terrorism. Marches over the last week right past Parliament Hill with thousands of people carrying a Hamas terrorist insignia, chanting Hamas terrorist slogans, calling for the removal of Jews from Israel, brazenly and very clearly praising the rape and murder of Israeli civilians on the October 7th attacks, and just the very weak need response to it, and the even somehow weaker response of Chrystia Freeland. We're going to talk about the Globe and Mail dug something up very interesting, although their response to it was a bit odd. Alberta's new review of the province's COVID response. You'll recall the Jason Kenney government had a review conducted by doctors that agreed with the Kenney government, and no surprise, they agreed with the Kenney government. Well, Smith has appointed some doctors who did not agree with the Kenney government, and the media are shocked that these people might not agree with what the Kenney government did. And we're going to do an update on the NDP leadership race. There was a cutoff for the membership sales for those who could vote in the NDP leadership race. It's shaping up much less interesting than I had hoped it was before Nenshi. Before Nenshi's entrance, it looked like it could really be anybody's game. But increasingly, it looks like purple is the new orange. So let's get into it from the top. Trudeau saying pretty clearly if, you know, provinces don't do his bidding, well, he's just going to go around them.
I'm just going to try and figure out ways to help Canadians directly as necessary. I'd always rather work with provinces, but if we have to, I will go around them and be there for Canadians because this economy deserves young Canadians getting the support they need.
Thank you. Nigel, do you think he was just maybe getting a little excited about himself, or is this something he means?
Oh, he means it. And I think the interesting takeaway from that one, apart from the substance of it, is that it is always in these little unguarded moments when he's away from the teleprompter that he reveals what he really thinks. You know, we got more than a 10-year supply of this from the time that in 2013 when he was asked like he was nobody at the time, not even the official opposition. That was the NDP. And he was asked on a women's TV program, what other country than Canada did he admire? And he said China, but it was their ability to get things done. Everybody kind of thought, well, that's a funny thing to say. But he meant it. He actually was...
And he's not actually wrong. They can actually get things done.
Well, yeah.
A tremendous human cost, but they can actually get something done.
Francis Dahmer was a chef, too.
All of these...
It's Corey being Corey.
Yeah. Okay. All of these ghost apartment blocks, I don't know whether they really, they're so great. But The point is, he thinks they are. And it was an unusual thing to say. And he said it in a casual moment. And then he'll say other things in casual moments. You think, you really think that? Well, here's another where he's away from the teleprompter. So, sir, what are you going to do? I just go around them. Well, you know what? We have a constitution. We have a set of rules. We have custom and procedure. And it is the observation of these things that has actually given Canada incredible stamina as a nation over the years. You know, to find, there's only four countries that you can find that have got a really long, enduring history of uninterrupted governmental action. Great Britain, the United States, Iceland, and Canada, going back to 1867. Now, sure, there are older countries, but, you know, the French are on their Fifth Republic. The Germans are on, you're not allowed to call it the Fourth Reich.
Second,
but, you know.
You got a Second Republic.
Second, all right, the Second Republic. You know, and all of this in the last, you know, in the time since Canada entered Confederation. So we got something right in 1867, and we've been doing it right. And now Mr. Trudeau thinks that we've been doing it wrong, and he can do better. He has not proved his case, gentlemen.
You know, federalism, as we think of it, I think evolved out of the feudal system, because feudalism, in a sense, had a lot of the characteristics of feudal of federalism. And you think kind of the structure of the Holy Roman Empire. There was a feudal relationship, but they were still sovereign in their own right post 30 Years' War. But I think Trudeau views federalism in the older feudal sense of owing allegiance to. And it's the senior liege's job merely to protect the lower one, the lower one's job to do the bidding of the higher. Or perhaps it's just more that he views the provinces as departments of the federal government that are annoyingly elected on their own. But they're simply just elected departments of a greater whole. And that's very much not the way it works. There is a queen of Alberta. There is a queen of Saskatchewan. It happened to also be the same as the Queen of England and the Queen of Canada. But their crowns in their own
king as we
sorry.
The monarch.
Old habits. Yes. Old habits die hard.
But, I liked her too.
Yeah. But Corey, I mean, like father like son here, the father had very, very little respect for the provinces. Would criticize Joe Clark as trying to be head waiter to the provinces, which is probably the nicest thing anyone's ever said about Joe Clark. But I don't know how much he can win here, because he's sparking such backlash coming right out of this. The Smith government here in Alberta introduced, I forget what they're calling this bill, but essentially forbidding municipalities in Alberta, which are constitutionally a part of the province, not separate on their own, forbidding them from dealing directly with the federal government, because the federal government for decades has tried to come in to deal with municipalities directly as a way of circumventing provincial jurisdiction. So Trudeau is just creating more and more backlash here, I think, making it increasingly difficult for him to impose his will on the provinces.
Yeah, I mean, Trudeau Sr. had no respect for the provinces, but at least he was smart enough to understand what the Constitution is. And I mean,
or to change it.
Yeah, yeah. So, Justin Trudeau, I don't think he really understands. We're a federation. We're not a unitary form of government. Like, we are built to have a degree of autonomy in these provinces. I don't think he really understands it. So this is just to, as far as he's concerned, it's paperwork. It's in the way. And he's got a bit of a, I think he's losing it to a degree, a messiah complex. I know what's best, and darn it, I'm going to get it done. And these guys are in the way, and I will do by hook or by crook what citizens need of me. It's really hitting that point when you, and Nigel said, it starts to slip out, and we're seeing it slip out more and more. He's been in too long. He's been surrounded, almost cloistered by people who, you know, yes, people. He's lost grip on what the role really entails, what the country is really built upon. And he doesn't understand what he's doing to this country, because unity is more fractured now than it's ever been.
He should have understood after the Supreme Court rejected his flagship Bill C-69, the No Pipelines Rule. Mm-hmm. Up until then, you could have said, well, he just doesn't get it. He doesn't think about monetary policy. He doesn't read his briefings. Okay, you know. But when the court actually turns around and says, no, what you did there was unconstitutional, and the best that he's got is come back and say, well, you know, we don't care. You know, we think it's constitutional. So he should have understood at that point. Now I think this is just perverse.
It is. He's trying a game almost. I mean, it's political play. When he goes to the municipalities, he's taking the money and he's trying to play sugar daddy and bringing it back, because that's how he's fighting with the provinces. And then as soon as, you know, the province speaks up, because he's bypassing them, he's trying to portray the premiers as being the ogres. Say, look, they're preventing me from doing good things. But I think most Canadians, and it's showing in the polls, understand Trudeau's dangling money they took from the, he took from their wallet in the first place.
Well, and it isn't just this most recent case where he openly said, well, the provinces don't do what I want, I'm going to go around them. There's been a lot of major constitutional court defeats for Trudeau. Now, he's had some wins that I think were dubious judicial merit, like on the carbon tax. That's going to get dismantled just through the plain old democratic system, not through constitutional protections. But he lost on the plastic straws ban and bans on water bottle drink box things, if you can recall that. He lost on the Emergencies Act, you know, where it was found pretty clearly to have been done inappropriately, not necessary, and a violation of basic constitutional rights. So it's not just against the provinces where he's been found, having a rather liberal interpretation of the Constitution. Even in as it involves going at violating the rights of individual people as well. You'd think someone who is the son of the man who's the primary author of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms would have some conception of its basic parameters and how it would be applied.
Well, you would, wouldn't you? But, you know, you just ran through a whole list of things. Well, here's a few more. He does not understand the ethics of what a prime minister can accept as a gift and what he must refuse on principle. It is unusual to have a prime minister reviewed by the ethics commissioner. I think it's 5 times that the ethics commissioner has come into his area and said, well, actually, sir, you know, you shouldn't actually do this. You have the whole scandal surrounding SNC-Lavalin, where very clearly long-standing customs and traditions of how things are done were completely overlooked. And the man is, I don't know, I still don't have an opinion as to whether he's foolish or whether he is ignorant or whether he's actually the smartest one of all of us because he's getting what he wants. But certainly there are enough people in the Privy Council office and around him in the Prime Minister's office to say, this you can do, this you can't, sir. And then he says, well, we're doing it anyway. Now that is the fracture in this whole thing. He thinks he can do anything if it's in a good cause.
Well, to a degree, he's right. As I said, maybe it's not so much brilliance, but I see it as more as a spoiled child. But he's realizing, too, that I can do this. I'll face sanction 2 years from now. The Supreme Court says, don't do that again. Oh, okay. I mean, there's no consequence. No. There never has been.
And also, like, once things get – it takes a long time for things to get struck down in court. Yeah. This morning, I was getting something at the coffee shop. I was getting a cold coffee. And I just brought a plastic straw from my truck that, you know, this contraband straw I bought on Amazon. And the coffee shop still has paper straws. Actually, the guy who runs it, he's angry about it. But it's just this unconstitutional paper straw law was imposed on them. And now it's just kind of stuck, even though the law is struck down. They've managed to largely get their way.
Well, I think the municipality still bans them under Gondek. We've got layers and layers to go through.
Well, because the issue there was that the federal government didn't have the right to do it, but provinces and municipalities perhaps do on a constitutional level. Yeah. What it meant is that even though this was unconstitutional, it was in place for long enough that it just largely became the norm among large corporations that pretty slow to change tack on these things. So he still kind of got his way, even though it was found to be totally unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, break time for a commercial. I'm going to try and get better at doing, like, not just immediately going in, doing a
segmented.
All right. We're going to stay on the topic of Trudeau here, but something that is within his area to control legally. And that's just what he says in reaction to events.
October 7th is proof that we are almost free. Long live October 7th. Long live the resistance. Long live the Intifada. Long live every form of resistance.
Openly cheering the rape and murder of women and children from the October 7th attacks, hailing Hamas, hailing Hamas's goals, carrying Hamas's symbols. You know, we can remember when there was one person had a National Socialist flag on Parliament Hill or near Parliament Hill during the trucker freedom convoy. And it was found that that person was almost certainly a false flag, almost certainly not a part of it, but appeared there. And in an instant, Trudeau had a comment. He knew to denounce that. I mean, that's an easy thing and a right thing to denounce, even though it was pretty clearly a false flag. We suspected at the time and have a large amount of evidence to prove afterwards, but he denounced it immediately, right then and there. Freeland, immediately, right there. This happens, and it takes... How long did it take Trudeau to denounce? It took Freeland days, several days. Took Trudeau forever, and actually, let's just play Trudeau's own response here, his own words. So, he's got to say it for himself. I'm not going to put words in his mouth. Nigel, would it have been difficult to say something a little tougher and sooner?
Well, you know, I think the obvious thing would have been to denounce people who had unacceptable opinions and were, for the most part, misogynist and racist. You know, I mean, how much more racist can you get than calling for the destruction of other people?
How much more misogynist can you get than raping people?
Or just... Let's not even go there. No, I mean, clearly this should have been the easiest thing in the world to say that's unacceptable in Canada. We don't go for that. We do not tolerate that. If we find out who's responsible, we're going to line them up. Yes, Canadians have a right to protest. He did say that. But they do not have a right to call for the extermination of a people, and especially a people that already knows far too much about extermination. That should have been easy. It writes itself. I didn't come prepared to say that. It just rolls off the tongue. That's who we ought to be, but apparently we're not. We have to really carefully think about it. And why do we do that? Probably because you don't want to upset all those potential Liberal voters. And frankly, gentlemen, if that's who a Liberal voter, if that's who that government is now depending on, it is even more a time for change.
Well, that's where I want to go with you, Corey, the Liberals have traditionally been strong with newer immigrant groups, you know, first and second generation. And that goes back some time. And there was an aberration for that in the 2011 election with Harper's majority government win. But, you know, traditionally the Liberals and not just in Canada, across much of the Western world, center-left and left parties tend to do better with immigrant groups. Right parties tend to be a bit more nationalistic and less welcoming of at least mass, large numbers of migration. But the Liberals have never been this, you know, they've always been a bit pandery, you know, like they'll wear the clothes and they'll show up to the events and, oh, fine, whatever. That's fine. That's it. That's retail politics. I get that. But I've never seen it so radically impact the domestic politics and the foreign policy of a government the way it has in the, you know, since October 7th here. How strong is the influence of this kind of hardline Islamist voter constituency as an impact on the Liberal Party's fortunes that they seem so reticent to denounce the most easily denounceable things in the world?
I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, that's just a fringe of an immigrant group. I mean, most Islamic people have no interest in slaughtering and wiping out the Jews. And we got large immigrant communities that certainly want no part in this fight, whether it's the Hindu community or Sikhs or so many others. So you're pandering to this micro of an offensive group that is been building, you know. It's been permissiveness for months with this group and excuses. Oh, they're just criticizing Israel. And then, oh, from the river to the sea, oh, you're interpreting that wrong. No, you're not. They want to squish Jews, guys. But okay, fine. Mm-hmm. We let that slide. But as it's gone on, the few who were a bit moderate, the few who perhaps really thought they were just being critical of Israel, they've left those protests, and that's why we're seeing the ugly core of it a lot more.
Or they have become some of them are getting worse.
But I mean, I think of an example we saw in Calgary the other week with that clown standing there with a big beatific grin on his face, doing a Nazi salute, holding up a picture of the Ayatollah, and at a group of Jewish people. And I mean, the messaging wasn't very subtle there. And a blue-haired, usual, typical white-bread progressive came up, and you could see her saying, you know, could you do that? And he basically told her.
The media's looking. Maybe don't do it right here.
You know, jam it up your ass, woman, he told her. And she wandered away in frustration. She might not be back to that demonstration. That was the voice. That was an example of seeing the voice of the moderate trying and losing. And now as we're seeing that corn, we're seeing how emboldened they are. That demonstration we saw earlier. They're not hiding it anymore. They're not criticizing Israel. They're celebrating, openly celebrating October 7th, the act of terrorism. And Trudeau's gotten himself into such a habit that he can't critique these people that even when they're practically on the veritable point of waving swastikas, he can't immediately say, okay, this is it. The line has been crossed. And they're going to be more bold next week and the week after, because as long as they realize there's no consequence to this, that extreme group is going to keep coming out. I don't think there's a large voter constituency, but it's like they've trained the liberals.
You know, I don't think there's a large constituency for people demanding Canada do something to assist in the annihilation of the Jews and the River to the Sea stuff. But I think there's also, you know, moderate anti-Israel, if we can call it that. You know, they want to cut down the size, you know, give it a bit of a thrashing, but they're not necessarily in the full-blown genocide
business. The naive two-state solution idea that every time Israel tries it, they get bombed for trying.
But, yeah.
But either way, I think it's a well-meaning, maybe
the
not...
admirably naive types there.
That's gone. This is pure hate now.
Yeah, but I think he's afraid of offending them too by seeing to take a side. And it's seen, and Trudeau, I think, sees it as taking a side, Nigel, to condemn a march in front of Parliament Hill calling for the annihilation of the Jews in Israel.
Well, then
he sees that as taking a side and therefore not engaging in the Canadian doublespeak, you know, peace broker role where we don't have to take a side.
If that really is how he sees it, then only thing I can say is he is wrong. You cannot give any room to a group of people recommending that another group of people be killed. That's un-Canadian. That's not what human. This country is about. It's not even ethically defensible in any other country, but good Lord.
I want to discuss also, where the hell are the police on hate speech here? Where are the hate speech laws? You know, you could get some crank, you know, in his basement in, you know, 1988, some Keekstra type putting out nasty things. And like, I don't know, maybe his pamphlets were read by like a couple of hundred people, probably very few of which ever gave it a second thought until he appeared on television after being charged. You know, just some crank. And we go after him. That's actually hateful. And then we have cases that are not hateful, like when the Human Rights Commissions came out for the Western Standard and Maclean's in the mid-2000s for publishing articles that radical Islamists found to be offensive, or cartoons that were found to be offensive. These things authorities are willing to go after as hate crimes. But then openly and brazenly calling for genocide, there's been nothing. There's been absolutely nothing, not even of the organizers, let alone other participants who were just shouting genocidal slogans.
So, Derek, if you have got a lone, solitary hate merchant in his basement in a small rural community, it doesn't take much for three squad cars to pull up outside the door, five to kick down the door and haul him away and charge him and put him through the ringer. When you have got hundreds, if not thousands, of people, not merely in one city, but in several others, you're starting to look at what the police are physically capable of doing. Do you want to call out the army in support of the civil power? That is an
option. They thought about doing it for a couple of truckers.
Well, they did. But you notice that they didn't think of doing it for this. They will let this go in the hope that it will stop, that it will all blow over, and that it will cease to be an issue by October of 2025. I don't know that it will, but that is the strategy. They do not have the force to counteract this.
I could see you couldn't stop it while it's in action without causing a potential riot.
No,
I mean,
it certainly would have been a riot. It would have been right there.
Problematic. But we're hearing even progressive voices. I mean, we're watching Warren Kinsella, for example. He is mortified by this. And he's saying openly, and he's always pro-immigrant and everything else, a lot of these people are not Canadian citizens yet. It wouldn't be that hard. You know, if you picked out 20 from each of these protests and suddenly they found themselves on a plane back to where they were going, or where they came from, I've got a feeling a whole lot of the people who are not Canadian citizens within those protests, I think maybe I should just kind of tone my message down a little bit because I don't want to be the next one back over there.
Free Gaza trips.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm not saying mass deportations, but just some examples. You came here to be a Canadian citizen. You're welcome. That's great. Make a life. But if you want to do that crap on our streets, here's the ticket home, guys. We don't have room for that. We got a lot of other people who would gladly fill your spot in this country. There's things the federal government could do if they found the will, but they don't have any indication.
They don't have the will. And I'm not sure they do have the strength, like the physical boots on the ground.
Also, it would be tough.
The courts and human rights commissions have intimated to a significant degree that they generally don't find it to be hateful if it's not essentially a white guy. Yeah. If it's Christian and white, that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's critical theory.
Because there can't be reverse racism. And in the
we sent Zumble back.
In the critical race theory world and all of this stuff, the Jews are now white. Now some appear to be white, some do not. In Israel, the majority do not appear to be white.
Sephardic Jews are pretty dark.
Exactly. They're not most of the Jews we would know, say, in Canada. Mm. Most are not Sephardic here. But they have essentially become white in this worldview. And therefore, they are capable of racism. They are capable of, what's the term they use?
Privilege
in these things.
Oppression.
They can be an oppressor. Yeah, and so there's just so much of this weird stuff going on. So, and therefore, you know, these groups that are marching, which are generally not white, although a lot of people cheering for genocide are now just dumb, liberal, white college kids. But they're apparently not privileged. But yeah, it's just that they're not able to be charged because they're not, they're a part of equity-seeking groups, is what they call it now. So.
So the old twin campus solution for Columbia University. The two campus solution?
Yes, one in America, one in Gaza.
You bet.
Let's just set up a new campus for them in Gaza. Let them go. Yeah. All right. So when Kenny was premier, you know, he had AHS conduct a review of how they did, and you know, the doctor appointed to head it and the panel appointed to do this. They had all come into this generally supporting the government's view of crackdowns, mandates, arrests, that kind of stuff. And surprise, surprise, they agreed that this was a good thing, that the government had conducted itself generally effectively and well. I think it's Carrie Tate of the Globe and Mail. Globe and Mail had an interesting article story, I think, just yesterday, there's a second panel in AHS commissioned by the Smith government to review the response. And unlike the Kenny panel, there are at least some doctors involved here that did not agree with everything the Kenny government did. So it's an interesting story that we're having a second review. I thought that was a good thing. But the general reaction from the pundit class, the media class, has been horror. How could we possibly have a review of government actions for people who were critical of the government? Because that report could be critical of the government's response. And I think here, we'll start with you, Corey. I think the reason the media is so upset about this is because the media was so all in on following government talking points during COVID. You know, we tried to position ourselves as a standard here between the mainstream media, which saw themselves as conveying good and reliable information, which unwittingly turned them into propagandists for the government. And then on the other side, you know, some people who, you know, read some unnamed blog from Azerbaijan that you've never heard before, and it, you know, full of conspiracy theories and just baseless loopholes and things like that. We tried to be independent, finding middle ground on a lot of these issues. But the Canadian legacy media and most of the legacy media around the planet, they were so all in on just repeating the government's message on these things and changing the message whenever the government's messaging changed as well. I think that's why they're so defensive here, is that how could there possibly be a credible review conducted by doctors that could come to the conclusion that the government was wrong, and therefore we were wrong.
Well, that's part of it. There's pride. They invested themselves in that messaging the whole time. But, I mean, do we want to learn from this or not? You know, if we did have an unvarnished look and it turned out, boy, yes, in fact, what they did saved, if we could find a measurable way, this many lives, fine, we've learned from that. But the problem they have is that doctor, and I'm forgetting his name offhand, Davison. Yeah. He said the emperor has no clothes, and there's some truth to it. I mean, that messaging was considered blasphemy at the time, but there was truth to it. The hospital hallways were empty. They'd shut down the hospitals except for the most dire of emergencies and deferred procedures, which had a very serious cost and health implications on people later. It is ridiculous that we don't talk about this, because this, whether unintentional or not, was a cost of the government policies. Did they save, theoretically, so many lives that it was worth deferring those cancer treatments, those hip surgeries, those other things, or not? Let's have a look at it. Let's have a look at it from a doctor who was willing at least to break the orthodoxy. He's still presumably a doctor, still cares about the well-being of people and patients, and it's ridiculous to shoot this down at this point just because you don't like the voice of the doctor who's questioning it right now.
Nigel, the media seem to have had no issues with the preconceived notions of the previous chair, of the previous Kenny panel, who went into it generally believing in at least the broad outlines of the government's actions at the time. That wasn't considered coming into this with a bias of preconceived notions. But now you have a guy who was critical of at least some government measures during this period, openly so. And all of a sudden, that's having preconceived notions about what should have going into this with a bias. Maybe untangle that for us.
Well, gosh, let's start with the gentleman himself. He was at one stage in his career head of emergency medicine. I believe it was in Red Deer. Mm-hmm. And so we're not talking about a fellow out in a rural area who can't get employed in town because there's something about him that people, this is a serious professional whose ideas may be right and they may be wrong, but they're not based on prejudice. This is somebody who is actually in the dill and who saw what was going on and had doubts about what was going on. So, like I said, I wouldn't presume to say that because he differs from the narrative, therefore he must be right. But I absolutely wouldn't say that because he varies from the narrative, he absolutely must be wrong and we should get somebody else who actually really understands this stuff. You know, we've seen this before. In 2022, the Canadian Medical Journal published an article in which it purported to review how Canada had done to that point, June 2022. Well, guess who they got to write the review? The people who wrote the rules 18 months before.
Yeah.
And what would you expect them to say? Oh, just everything worked just great. Well, this was actually a time of lockdowns, enormous economic damage, children being kept out of school. We're still seeing the effects of that. There is no way that you can go back to the authors of the rules and say, well, how did it work out? Of course it's going to work out great, so maybe you should have somebody like, I believe his name is Davison, you should have somebody like that come in and say, well, let's just look at this again. The whole problem is, who do you trust to review something like this? None of us should ever trust any agency of the federal government, because they are the same people who wrote the rules. Mm-hmm. They are going to say it was great. Do I trust, do I trust the National Citizen Inquiry? Well, I'd like to. I think they did wonderful work. But when all is said and all is done, they don't have the official imprimatur of an agency that you can hold to account. Mm-hmm. Well, Preston Manning had some, I thought his report was helpful, didn't go far enough. I hope this report goes the distance.
All right. Well, I want to turn towards the NDP's leadership race in Alberta here. You know, I hate to say it, but man, New Democrats are so much nicer to each other than conservatives. conservatives know how to have a leadership race. It's
gloves off.
It's World War III every time. I mean, it's never a tame affair. It's life and death. Now, normally because you're fighting to be the premier. Now, this is the first real NDP leadership race ever. The NDP leadership race 2014 that elected Rachel Notley. I could be wrong. Someone correct me after if I'm wrong, but I think it was about 5,000 people voted.
Yeah, like, something like that. It was very small.
There are UCP local nomination races that get that in a single constituency. The entire NDP across Alberta had about 5,000 votes cast in that leadership race because you were running to be the leader of the fourth party. It was an insignificant fringe party that became the government because of a wild set of circumstances that we won't have to rehash here. This is the NDP's first real leadership race where you are auditioning to be the leader of the opposition and potentially premier. The NDP can conceivably win power in Alberta now. So it's actually a decent political job. If you're on the left in Alberta, it's probably the best job short of being a federal liberal cabinet minister. So it's a big deal ish, but it's been so low profile. So before we get into, I guess you can take it wherever you want, but why do you, we'll start with you, Nigel. Why do you think it's been such a polite and dull affair compared to the last two UCP leadership races that, you know, were just short of, you know, Omaha Beach?
Hmm. Well, a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that conservatives worry about principles and they get very defensive of them. I'm not sure that's a bad thing.
I'm not sure the NDP don't hear. Like, there's a lot of dedicated socialists there who care about their ideas.
That was my second point. I'm not in front of the children. You know, we can rip each other apart behind closed doors, but let's look respectable when we present ourselves to the public. We'll see how it goes in some of the debates, because there are some personalities in that group of five people who I think won't be able to hold back when it finally comes to it.
Well, they haven't had debates yet.
But yeah, we'll see old Gil. He's still, you know.
Yeah, he's going to have a hard time playing nice.
It's going to be too bad for him that I guess it's 100% membership vote now. There's not a 20% allocation for the unions anymore.
Yeah, they still get an allocation on the board of the party, but not in the leadership vote.
That's right. That's going to be... I imagine they're busy cutting each other's throats behind closed doors. But they'll deny it.
Because I expected more, too. Like, this is an existential race for this party. Are we going to swing to a more moderate left of center under Nenshi Alberta Party, old red Tory sort of look, or are we going to stay true to our NDP principles? And I thought there'd be a lot more fight. And I got a feeling with those first membership numbers, this is just a guess on my part, though, is that Nenshi's blown them out of the water so badly already, they realize that any more fighting at this point is going to be detrimental to the party. So let's ride out this race, put across our points, but it's going to be a coronation.
That's what I'm thinking is probably there's probably two things. One is the left tends to not to eat their own as much as the right does, particularly in Alberta. We love nothing more than killing ourselves. It's fun.
Hey, we're guilty of it.
Few are more guilty than me and you. Like we just love it for very bad reasons, sometimes good reasons, but. The left tend to, they kind of deal their dirty laundry behind closed doors more. If they have a defeated candidate, they find them a job or they kind of take care of their own, you know, like a union. The right, much less so. But I think one of the big issues here is that the other campaigns might know that Nenshi has essentially got this in the bag. So going too hard after him could see you not be on the front benches anymore. I could see you on the outs and also just overall hurt the party. Why tarnish the purple paint that they're putting on? Nigel, do you think the anecdotal numbers we're hearing out of the NDP is that he's doubled the membership, and you know, if you have doubled the membership, you need to convince, you know, a very small number of existing members at that point to vote for you. Does it look to you like this is just going to be a purple coronation?
Well, it would be the sensible opinion to hold, wouldn't it? New members, you have to make sure they vote as well. Uh-huh. The old members will. To the degree which he has won the party, it's interesting to note, having an endorsement from a sitting MLA is not the same as signing up 100 new members for a vote. But It is interesting to note that Hoffman has got five existing MLAs and seven who ex-MLAs, Ganley 8 plus 6. Nenshi has got 9 plus 2, which isn't bad. But, you know, it's not as if everybody is just falling in behind the procession to the throne. So I'm still looking for a vigorous debate and maybe maybe a second ballot.
Most MLA and MP endorsements, 99 times out of 100, mean nothing. Look how many MLAs endorsed who was the main opponent of Smith in the leadership race, former finance
minister. Taves.
Travis Taves. Damn near the whole caucus. Mm-hmm. Smith started off, she eventually scrapped together one. I think by the end she had maybe three or four.
A handful, yeah.
Out of the large governing caucus, she had a very small number. Because most local MPs and MLAs can't carry anyone in their riding. They're just there. There'll be the odd local MLA who can organize and can turn out a constituency, but they're pretty rare in most circumstances. Mm-hmm. So the endorsements look nice. I think they might matter in the sense of, oh, does this person have support in caucus and therefore can, you know, build a team? Might matter from that. But actual MLAs and MPs, only the rarest of circumstances can actually bring more votes along than their own household.
Well, and then she's showing to have a good organizational mechanism. I mean, that's the thing. Selling the membership is one thing, you got to get them out too. Mm-hmm. But looking at the well-communicated, well-organized rallies he's been holding all over the province, good turnouts for this sort of race and a quiet time for the NDP, presumably that organizational group also knows that they have to stay in touch and get these people out to vote. So mm-hmm. he's showing quite a demonstration of strength. It'll be difficult.
And stay tuned. Word is one of the lesser-known candidates, that'd probably be Gil McGowan or
Julie Callahoo Stonehouse.
Yeah, one of those two is likely to drop out and back Hoffman. So are we also now going to see the Anybody But Nenshi movement come? We don't have time for it today.
I hope so.
Stay tuned next week, kids. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining today. And thank all of you for joining us on The Pipeline. I hope you've enjoyed yourself and walk away a little more informed than when you sat down. Remember that the Western Standard does not accept any of the federal government's media bailout money. We rely on memberships, subscriptions from ordinary people like you. If you're not yet a member of the Western Standard, go to westernstandard.news right now. Sign up. It's only $10 a month or $100 a year to get unlimited access to all Western Standard content. We publish 40, 50 pieces a day. It's quite a I can't believe how much we actually put up from here, but it's quite something, and we're one of the only publications left in Canada, one of a very, very, very small number that don't take the federal government's media bailout money. So thank you very much for joining us today and all your support, and God bless. You can become a Western Standard member for just $10 a month or $99 a year for unlimited access.